I'm Meriden Varel, the director of the East Asia program at the Lowy Institute. I'm joined today by Dr. Alana Kolakowski, who is currently at the China Institute at the University of Alberta. Alana focuses on high-tech industry in China. Welcome, Alana. It's great to have you here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a thrill to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. So we're going to talk today about understanding China's aerospace developments. And we're going to start with an assumption that I think a lot of people would have about where China is in the world of innovation and aerospace development. And I think that most people would be of the understanding that China is not really doing terribly much. Maybe we have a stereotype that it's still a developing country, still years away from doing anything big and amazing. But your research suggests that's completely misplaced.
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of people still tend to view big Chinese companies as capable of, say, incremental innovation or imitation, but not really at the forefront of any technical area. But actually, there are some areas in which China's made remarkable achievements recently. A really good example is China's foray into large commercial aircraft manufacture. Just a couple of months ago, China's first domestic large commercial aircraft completed its maiden flight. The C919 is billed as a Chinese-made aircraft, and indeed the airframe is Chinese, and the major manufacturer, the system integrator, is a Chinese company, COMAC. China's also home to the world's largest space radio telescope, which represents a really significant engineering achievement and a very substantial innovation in telescope design. So the 500-meter aperture radio space telescope in China's southwest is a great example of a major engineering breakthrough in China. And of course, recently you may have seen headlines about China's first-time proof of concept, a demonstration of a quantum communication satellite technology, in which China's Mishi satellite beamed down photons to two ground stations, basically achieving a world first in what could someday become quantum communications technology.
So these three examples are all technological marvels, really, in and of themselves.
They are really substantial achievements. They're not just first-time successes for China. They're often world firsts, at least in the case of the last two. China has the world's largest space radio telescope and has really demonstrated a concept that hadn't been tested before with its quantum communication satellites.
So how has this happened? I mean, we have this understanding of China, perhaps a misunderstanding of China. How have they come to these incredible achievements recently?
Yeah, there are a few factors at play. There are many, it turns out, what we can learn from looking at these cases a little bit more closely is that there are actually many different ways to achieve technological success. And some of those run counter to our expectations about what innovation looks like. So if you've read about China's innovation prospects in the past, you may have heard that there are some cultural inhibitions that prevent innovation in China or that make Chinese firms, Chinese research and development institutions unlikely sites of innovation. People blame the Chinese educational system for fostering rote learning. They blame the culture within state-owned enterprises and a number of other soft factors for hindering real breakthroughs, for making these institutions conservative and risk averse. But actually, some of the outfits that have produced the most remarkable technological achievements in China recently are really from deep within the state-owned industrial system. They're what we think of as the antithesis of the ideal innovation environment. These are large, lumbering, behemoth, administratively, bureaucratically onerous institutions. They're the exact opposite of the Googleplex of our imagination that we think of as being a really innovation-friendly environment. But they can succeed too. And what we see now is that in different sectors, different kinds of organizations with different organizational structures, different internal cultures, sometimes seemingly very conservative and hierarchical, can actually really produce technical breakthroughs.
Yeah, well, the evidence suggests that they really have done. And do you think this is sectorally specific, though? Do you think this is something that is maybe happens in the in these aeronautical aerospace areas, but maybe couldn't be applied in IT?
I mean, we see that actually Chinese firms are very successful in IT too. So obviously different sectors are probably more conducive or more hospitable to different types of firms. What works in a really hardware-heavy, old-fashioned manufacturing sector like aircraft manufacture might not work as well in, say, IT, where the technology refresh rate is so fast and where nimble, agile, small firms tend to do really well. But we see that the Chinese system actually accommodates a really, really wide range of different types of firms, public, private, large, small, seemingly bureaucratic, seemingly very nimble. Overall, though, you can say that across the entire science and technology system or the science and technology establishment in China, there's been a tremendous improvement over the past decade or two in the kind of work environment that scientific and technical personnel enjoy. There are probably at least three big factors that have really reshaped research and development institutions of all kinds in China. The first is that they're much more institutionalized than they used to be. So as recently as 20 years ago, research and development programs in China were usually launched on an ad hoc basis, kind of high mobilization programs designed to meet some very pressing need for a particular technology. Today, they're much more systematic, much more structured, formal. They have set processes in place. And that in and adds a lot of programmatic stability, policy stability to the environment. And it makes it possible to do really, really big projects that it wasn't possible to do before.
And this is a big shift from how it had been in the past, where it was more sort of politically driven, ad hoc kind of projects. Is that right?
Yeah, that's another really big change, is that you see a lot more evidence of scientific and technological programs being run by experts for experts. You see that the political fortunes of a program don't depend as much as they used to on one particular elite scientist or one elite engineer's alliance with a high-powered bureaucrat or a general, for example, as they did not very long ago. So the whole workforce is in a way a lot more professionalized. In other words, a lot less politicized than it used to be.
Yeah. And I guess you talked a little bit in your paper as well about the importance of specialization in the workforce as well as another factor.
Yes. There are the number of institutions doing research and development in China has literally exploded. There's been just a dramatic multiplication in the number of distinct little outfits that are engaged in some form of R&D. Something like 6,000 registered official research and development units exist across China today. So you'd be very hard-pressed to find any single major area of science and technology, whether it's some little patch of nanotechnology or some little piece of submarine design or some aspect of biotech, that doesn't have either a dedicated lab or an institute or a fund or a program of some sort. So there's so many more of these really focused units looking at one particular niche area than there were in the past.
Rightio. So do these changes then suggest that, I mean, we talked a little bit about the China model in terms of the organizational structure and dynamics as being quite different from the Googleplex ideal. But in terms of the these work environments, the institutionalization, the professionalization, and the specialization, does that mean that it's heading towards a model that's more similar to the US and to the European approaches?
I think the answer to that is yes and no. You can probably say that in some ways, maybe China's research and development institutions today look a lot more like their German counterparts, certainly than they did 30 years ago. But on the other hand, you can't really conclude that China's model is fundamentally similar to either a North American or a European model. I think when you look at the role of the state in science, technology, and innovation, you can imagine different degrees of involvement. In most European, North American, and say in the Australian economy, you can imagine the state as designing the chessboard on which
innovation takes place. So you can imagine that the government aims to create a kind of landscape that's conducive to innovation, but it doesn't necessarily engage in too much specific innovation activity itself, on the margins here and there, but the main thrust is creating an overall policy environment that's conducive to innovation. In China, the state does all of that. It does draw the lines on the chessboard, but it does a lot more. It draws the lines on the chessboard, it sets the rules of the game, and more importantly, it creates some of the little figures that move around the chessboard, and it pushes them around here and there. So you can imagine the state playing a far stronger role in actually guiding the conduct of specific firms and specific institutions, and really giving substantive content to their activities in a way that you just doesn't find a parallel in any other major industrialized economy.
Right. So this is not the same as the kind of fragmented authoritarianism model that we've heard about, you read about in terms of, you know, China's approach to policy as being, you know, a bit of a mess, for want of a better way of explaining it. That this is not fragmented.
It is and it isn't. I once heard a famous scholar of China say that if you can find an example of A in China, you can also find an example of B. And I think that's also true of innovation. So China is such an enormous economy, and there's so much innovation activity happening across different levels that you see all different kinds of outcomes. And it's true that in some areas there are undoubtedly challenges around policy coordination and the actual implementation of high-level directives. But at the same time, though, in high-priority areas, in areas that the government really deems to be strategic or emerging, that it's identified as belonging to the commanding heights of the economy or having some other systemic function, there really is a very high degree of mobilization and coordination. And the proof of that is in the pudding. You just look at China's major advances in space, which is undoubtedly a high priority sector, or you look at its major advances in commercial or defense aircraft manufacture, and you also see substantial advances. That doesn't mean that it's perfect, but it means that a lot is happening very quickly.
Right. And would you say that other kind of policy sectors are, when you're talking about moving things around on the chessboard, they're brought in to support these high priorities? So education, for example, or other policy areas are really, when necessary, aligned to fit with this bigger strategy?
Yeah, I think you can see that, again, around these big high priority areas, there is a huge amount of coordination across policy areas. So in China, economic policy is industrial policy, is innovation policy, is science and technology policy. And that is in turn in some sectors education policy, and it gets translated into environmental policy and public health policy.
Right.
So around critical technologies, critical areas that are identified as strategic, there is a high level of policy integration in that way.
Great. And so when we're talking about aerospace policy and aeronautical policy, that is to say, things that go out into the great blackness and things that stay in the blue, for want of, versus trying to put it in layperson's terms, that we do see different approaches to these policy areas. Can you talk a little bit about what the differences are and how they have come about?
Yeah. So China's aeronautic and space industries face a pretty different international environments to begin with. So China's access to foreign aeronautic technology, so civil commercial aircraft technology, is far greater than its access to civil commercial space technology because of controls on US and European, especially items in the space sector. But even before the strictest of those controls were in place, we saw that the sectoral development strategy adopted by the Chinese government was very different in aeronautics than it was in space. In aeronautics, you could say that the broad thrust of China's development strategy is to create national champion firms that will integrate into a global manufacturing industry and serve a global market. And that means that in those sectors, the focus is really on nurturing domestic aircraft manufacturing capabilities that will prepare those firms to join global value chains, to participate in those transnational supply networks that are so well developed in that industry, but really belong to them at the best possible nodes, at the optimal nodes where Chinese firms can earn high value added and maybe master some particularly important technologies. So in the short term, what that means is that the Chinese government doesn't really aspire to build up a national aircraft manufacturing industry that's completely vertically integrated. It wants one that's selectively integrated into the international, the global aircraft manufacturing world. That means that Chinese companies undertake really substantial partnerships with foreign firms. So, for example, China's latest airliner program, the C919 program, is made by COMAC, or the main system integrator for that program is COMAC, Commercial Aircraft of China. COMAC is the maker of the airframe for that aircraft, but all of the important subsystems for that aircraft are supplied by joint ventures between Chinese aircraft manufacturing entities and foreign counterparts. So those joint ventures bring in all the leading U.S. and European companies, for example, and some Japanese companies, to supply this ostensibly Chinese aircraft program.
Right. And sorry, just you said earlier as well that the second round of the COMAC is going to be a Russia-China joint venture. Is that right?
Yeah. So as we understand it right now, the successor to the C919 is going to be a slightly larger aircraft, provisionally called the C929. And that aircraft's will represent a really substantial partnership between aviation industries of China and its subsidiary COMAC and a Russian counterpart. So that aircraft might herald the re-entry of a large Russian firm into commercial aircraft manufacture. So that's a really new turn for China's aerospace industry. Distancing it perhaps a little bit from its European and U.S. partners, and certainly bringing it closer to a new partner in Russia.
Fascinating. So in the way that we're talking, we're talking not entirely vertical integration in the aeronautical policy sector, but the aerospace sector is something very different.
Yeah, space is really, really different. Since all the way dating back to Mao, China's leaders have understood that or believed that China ought to have a set of core national capabilities in space, that it needed to achieve a level of autonomy in space technology so that it wouldn't have to rely on the Soviets or the Russians or the Americans. That's been a really long-held commitment. More recently, China just doesn't have access to a lot of space items that it would want to import from the rest of the world, mainly because of export controls implemented by the United States, but also in partnership with other allied countries since World War II. So China's had to go it alone in space recently. And the lack of access has probably just encouraged and intensified that commitment. So you could say that the government's vision for developing space capabilities today is really to build a comprehensive, holistic, scientific, technical, and industrial base in China so that any technology on the critical path toward a major space mission could be domestically supplied. That doesn't mean that the Chinese space establishment is closed to international cooperation, but it means that any international cooperation is likely to really take place only when it serves that higher goal. And ultimately, any international cooperation can be a bonus or an extra, but it can never be allowed to substitute for or interfere with the development of those core national capabilities. There might be occasional deviations from that, but what we see all along is a very, very strong commitment to developing space, assured national space capabilities comprehensively within China.
So it sort of is a bit reminiscent of current President Xi Jinping's, you know, rejuvenation narratives and these ideas of, for want of a better expression, making China great again. But these ideas have actually, they go back to the late 1970s and the early 1980s. So even when public resources were incredibly scarce, there was still this enormous commitment, this incredible political commitment to self-reliance in this sector, in the space sector in particular. How do you think it sort of fits with Xi Jinping's sort of current narratives and goals for China?
I think the idea of making China successful in high visibility, high profile, high tech sectors that signal its modernity and its achievement and its contribution to science and technology at the global cutting edge, all of those are really consistent with this vision. There's no question. I guess the way I see it is that I take a longer term view. And I think if you reach back, if you look at some of these astonishing accomplishments that we see most recently, they're really the fruit that result from seeds planted decades ago by Xi Jinping's predecessors. So in some ways, Xi Jinping's administration today presides over the culmination of these efforts and maybe gets to reap some of the symbolic rewards of these accomplishments. But they really owe to the foresight of China's leaders of decades ago. They go back, in some case, to programs established under Deng Xiaoping, certainly accelerated and intensified under Jiang Zemin and then Hu Jintao. I think what we see also is that Xi Jinping's administration is unlikely to stray from this focus. China has a few very ambitious long-term strategies for science and technology programs in key areas. Space and aeronautics are among them. I think we're likely to see a very steady, really an almost unfaltering commitment to those goals going forward. And that's likely to be the case even if the Chinese economy sputters a little bit, even if the central government's coffers aren't quite as overflowing with wealth as they were in recent years, because the political commitment is really, really very strong.
That's really interesting. So it's not about it's not necessarily a practical program at all. There's a great underlying motivation of national pride and a nation building project that's going to keep this on track for years to come.
I think it's both. Like any really, really big government spending effort anywhere, there are probably multiple rationales for it and multiple justifications for it. I think some economists might say, well, some of these programs don't really represent the best use of scarce public resources in China, nor do they really align with China's factor endowment strengths, which lie in abundant labor. Labor that's more expensive than it used to be, but still very, very abundant. A lot of these high-tech programs are capital-intensive, they don't require many people, and they might even produce widgets that replace laborers. So they might actually, in some long-term sense, exacerbate unemployment. But I think the way China's leaders see it, China ought to be active at the technological frontier. It has to do everything. So the Chinese government should attend to basic development goals. It should attend to optimally redistributing labor and capital. It should attend to diffusing existing, including lower tech or lower end technologies throughout the economy to maximize the developmental benefit that those can yield. But in parallel to doing all of those things, all of the things that we normally think of as worthwhile, like investing in health and education and all the basic infrastructure, the government also is committed to developing capabilities at the forefront. And so there are like multiple tracks of policy in China. And the piece that I look at is at the spearhead of that, at that very frontier of high tech that the government aspires to create capabilities in.
Yeah. So given this political commitment, as we were talking about, and that it's likely to continue into the future, if I can just bring it back a little bit to Australia. In Australia, we have to oversimplify a little bit, we have this kind of bifurcated view that China represents a commercial opportunity, but at the same time, a strategic threat. To some extent or another. What do you think this kind of, what you've been talking about, the continued commitment to aerospace investment and progress and innovation in China, what do you think that means to countries like Australia in terms of what we should do in the way that we see China and understand what China means to us?
Yeah, well, I think every major economy trades with China. So every major economy is facing some form of this debate or this sort of national conversation about what are the opportunities and the threats that inhere in China's growing economic clout, in the growing economic reliance that might even exist in that economy on China and on exports to China. So I think that that's happening everywhere, just in different degrees and with slightly different kind of focal points in different economies. In Canada, we have a similar conversation where I'm from. I think that on the economic side, there's a lot going on, but you could say that one general tendency or one sort of overarching feature of the China landscape for most major firms is that they just can't afford not to be active in China. High-tech companies, whatever their sector, whether it's IT or aeronautics or space, have to invest in research and development. For those companies to be competitive tomorrow, they have to be innovating today. And for them to be innovating today, they have to have made sales yesterday. They have to have revenue to dedicate, to invest into R&D. So the proposition of withdrawing from the Chinese market, which is often the largest of any global market for their goods, is just not really available. They have to sell in order to innovate, in order to remain competitive. So the question isn't really whether they enter the Chinese market, it's more how. They have to find very tailored, evolving, probably pretty agile and reversible strategies to optimize how they can perform in the Chinese market. But it's not if, it's how. On the defense side, I think what taking a really close look at China's civil and commercial high-tech programs reveals, insofar as those are a window onto defense innovation, what those programs, what the civil commercial programs reveal is that there's very little outside actors can do to actually shape the course of innovation in China. In the space sector, a lot of civil commercial technologies have been denied to China. And nonetheless, we see that the Chinese space establishment has made phenomenal advances. On the other hand, in the aeronautics sector, Chinese companies have enjoyed a much more permissive international environment where they've been able to import a lot more foreign technology. And what do we see? Similarly astounding and impressive advances. The moral of that story is really that give China the technology, it'll do great. Don't give China the technology, it'll also do great. So the prospect of somehow restraining or interfering with China's pursuit of defense capabilities, I think is a pretty elusive one. Outside actors have to take stock of just how limited are the means that they ever could use to slow or alter or reorient the course of China's defense modernization, if that's even what they wanted to do. So the takeaway, I think, is really that the best that economies in which the government is skeptical of China's defense modernization can do is kind of look after their own. The Australias, the Canadas, the Germanys of this world can't change what happens in Canada, in China, but they can change what happens within their own economies. So what they can, and in my view should focus on, is really fostering the best possible innovation capabilities at home. That means investing in education, investing in health, smartly supporting innovation initiatives where they make sense, creating a policy environment that's conducive to science, technology, and innovation at home. So that the next revolutionary technology, with all of its strategic and political implications, is more likely to be shaped there than in a place far beyond their control.
Yeah, I think there's so much more that we could discuss and talk about there, about China's aerospace future, where it's come from and where it's going. I'd just like to let people know that Alana has put a chapter as part of the China Update this year, and that's available online. If you search for, what's the best way to search for it?
ANU Press and China Update will, in Google, will pull up that result.
Alana, thank you so much for joining me today. That's just been fascinating. I've learned absolutely heaps about what's going on in these sectors in China. Thank you again for joining me, and all the best for the rest of your stay in Sydney.
Thank you so much for having me.